use the standard candles, we use them to study the expanding universe. But I'm not interested in those. I'm interested in core collapse supernova, which is a completely different process. You have the iron core in an evolved massive star, so any star more than 8 solar masses. The core collapse is when it can no longer withstand the force of gravity. So when the electron degeneracy pressure holding up the iron core is not enough to prevent collapse. So it collapses all the way to nuclear densities, and the binding energy released in that collapse is around 10 to the 53 ergs. Most of this is released in neutrinos. Some is released in kinetic energy of actually removing the mantle of the star. At the end of the day, you have some compact object. That's where all the gravitational binding energy came from. So a neutron star or a black hole. This is what a massive star looks like at the end of its life. Plotted is the mass fraction, log mass fraction, of 20 different nuclear species at the versus enclosed mass at the point at which the iron core is starting to collapse. So you generally hear of a star having an onion skin-like structure. You can kind of see that here. This is hydrogen and helium out here for the outer, say, 4 solar masses. Then you have a helium shell that's a couple solar masses, an oxygen shell, which is a couple solar masses. There's a little silicon shell here, and then iron in the center. So this this comes from MESA, an open source stellar evolution code. It's a 25 solar mass star. It loses a lot of mass. It loses 12 solar masses during its evolution just from main sequence wins or post main sequence wins. It's a red supergiant, so it's very big, 1500 solar radii, and has a very cool temperature, a red temperature. So it's a red supergiant. This is what we get, when I say we, I mean like a core collapse theorist, get from a stellar evolutionist. And we take this, we map it into our hydro grid. We just map this part in here and run it and try and explode it. So as I said, the core collapse is when the gravity is too strong for the electrons to maintain the hydrostatic nature of that iron core. It collapses all the way to nuclear densities there. Your nucleons start to run into each other, and you're able to then at least temporarily reach some hydrostatic equilibrium again. Your pressure is large enough to withstand the force of gravity. So this is at nuclear densities, so densities around 10 to the 14. You start off at densities around 10 to the 9 grams per cubic centimeter. And your iron core, it's about 1,000 kilometers big. So this is your iron core in here. So it's going to collapse all the way at nuclear densities. It'll stop collapsing when it gets enough because of this nuclear pressure. The rest of the star that's falling in, and you'll see the velocity profile, it will be falling in. It's supersonic, but it has to settle onto this protoneutron star, so you'll form a shock as that material slows back down through the sound speed. And the shock will initially propagate out. And then stall. That was it stalling there. Play it again. So this is radial velocity on the right and density on the left. The shock stalls because initially it propagates out because this protoneutron star in here that's at these very high densities now is very hot. All that gravitational binding energy is basically turned into thermal pressure and forces the shock out to maybe 100 kilometers. But it's also very hot, so it's radiating, and it's radiating neutrinos because the temperatures are of order MeV. So it's radiating neutrinos, and that's taking away energy, taking away thermal pressure, and causing the material behind the shock to have a smaller pressure and not be able to push this shock out any further. So there's a balancing act going on here between the thermal pressure behind the shock and the ram pressure outside the shock, pushing down the shock. And this cooling due to neutrinos and some other processes basically make it so that the shock becomes an accretion shock. So this stalling of the shock, this slowing down around 100 kilometers or so, is a robust feature. It's a robust feature in 1D, 2D, and 3D. But in 1D, it doesn't get re-energized. So that's also a robust feature of 1D simulations, that you cannot re-energize the shock and make the supernova explode. In 2D, you can, when you include detailed microphysics, get the shock to be re-energized and start propagating out to large radii. So that shock is what will eventually explode the star. So this shock. The trouble is in 2D that we're finding the explosions, when we treat all the physics as accurately as we can, the explosions are not very energetic. So not what we see when we look at core collapse supernova in the sky. So the asymptotic energies are of order 10 to the 50 erg, the kinetic energies of the materials, but we observe more like 10 to the 51. So we might be able to get a few times 10 to the 50, but we're still a factor or two off of reproducing common supernova.
So things are sufficiently under control that you would believe factors of 2 being a problem, factor of 5, even a factor of 10 being a problem. There's even this numerical errors themselves. And missing physics. So is this, what I'm trying to say is that this is a real problem?
Well, that's a lot of energy, right? It's a factor of 10 or a factor of 5 is a lot of energy.
It is, but this is a very tough problem to get at.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of other processes going on as well. So you do have... as your shock runs out through the oxygen, that oxygen will burn to nickel. And so there's other processes that you have to model as well that may give you energy. So that would give you binding energy as you burn that oxygen to nickel. And as the nickel decays, you'll get energy out. So it could be that we're just not doing it good enough and not summing up the energies correctly.
Is there a natural way to estimate your errors?
Not really. I mean, you could do a different resolution. Then generally, you'll get a different result. But
so what is the resolution that nature has?
Yeah. Well, infinite resolution. So that could be the problem. Maybe we're just not giving it enough resolution. The trouble is, those are very expensive. 2D simulations with twice the resolution are much more expensive than the resolution that people can typically do. So it could be, it could just be numerical error.
Is it possible to do it at lower resolution and extrapolate up?
I think you quickly get in the, I mean, there's, I'm not saying the simulations are not convergent in the sense that if you increase the resolution, you're not going to get a wildly different answer. If you decrease the resolution, you might get a wildly different answer.
That means you're not in the convergent.
Well, this is turbulence, right? You can't resolve turbulence accurately unless you get convergence there too. You can get convergence only for average quantity.
Some instabilities might be triggered deeper, which are not accounted for here.
For sure, yeah. Yeah, so in 3D, we don't really have any long-term simulations that are accurate, that include enough physics that we can really learn anything from the 3D simulations yet. There's many ways that people think a core collapse supernova explodes. So the main way is the neutrino mechanism, and this is when the neutrinos streaming from the protoneutron star, and I said there's a lot of them, 99% of the energy is radiated in these neutrinos, have a small coupling to the matter behind the shock and can heat the matter behind the shock and re-energize that and cause the explosion to happen. So this is something that has been proposed for a while. In 1D, it doesn't work. In 2D, when you combine it with hydrodynamical instabilities, you can start to get explosions via the neutrino mechanism. But as I said, they seem to be under-energetic. And in 3D, again, we don't really know what's going on in 3D. If your star is rapidly rotating, then you can maybe explode via the magnetorotational mechanism, just via something like the MRI, the magnetorotational instability, transferring rotational energy to heat behind the shock to re-energize that material and explode it. You could have maybe a phase transition that would also cause some energy to be input into the material behind the shock and cause an explosion. But the neutrino mechanism is kind of what people think is likely to occur and likely to be the way supernova explode, although we can't definitively show that. So in general, a kind of an overview, two things can happen. You can explode or you cannot explode. So if you do explode, we see the supernova in the sky. We're left with neutron stars. We see this, we see neutron stars inside of supernova remnants. So this is most likely the most common channel where you re-energize your shock, explode, and you're left with a neutron star. You could fail to re-energize your shock, and then what will happen is you'll just accrete material onto the protoneutron star until the protoneutron star becomes too massive to hold itself up against gravity, and it'll collapse to a black hole. So that's another way ending up as a black hole. And we know that there's stellar mass black holes out there. We can observe them in binaries. And so we know that this must be a channel as well. Some supernova must fail. So now we'll talk about what stars are more likely to fail and maybe what stars are more likely to explode. But first, some select observations that tell us maybe, that hint at maybe black holes. So this is a study by SMART in 2009 where they looked at type 2P supernova. So type 2P supernova are supernova that come from red supergiants. And they went, once the supernova happened, they go back to archival footage and see if they can see the star that was there before it exploded. And then using stellar evolution models, they can guess at a mass for that star. And then this is what they plot here. For all these supernovas, they plot the mass, the initial zero age main sequence mass of that star. And they find, although there's controversy in this, that the maximum mass of type 2P supernova is around 17 solar masses. So they don't observe any type 2P supernova that have initial masses greater than around 17 solar masses. But we see red supergiants up to 25 solar masses, or our models say that they go up to 25 solar masses. So there seems to be some issue there with where are the type 2P supernova between 17 and 25 solar masses. So they could be black holes. They could not be type 2P supernovas when they explode. So there's lots of explanations for that resolving where these stars are. You can also compare the star formation rate with the supernova rate. So the star formation rate will tell you how many massive stars you make. The supernova rate will tell you how many explode. Any difference between them, one could assume, would be ones that don't explode. And so with significantly large errors, these two rates are off by roughly a factor of two. So it would suggest that half the mass of stars, if you took this without considering the errors, that half the mass of stars do not explode, but the errors are pretty big. And then, of course, I already mentioned this, we do see black holes in binaries with other things. So we know they do exist, and we know that their masses are maybe around 8 solar masses typically, but they can extend up to higher masses, 15, 20 solar masses. But we kind of don't see any at low masses. This is called the black hole gap. And we don't really know if that's a selection bias or whether or not it's hard to form black holes at those low masses. Okay, so for two parts of the talk, for the part on black holes and neutrinos, I'll be using GR1D. It's a open source, spherically symmetric, general relativistic hydrodynamics code for studying core collapse supernova and going all the way to black hole formation. So these are some details about it. I'm gonna, because I'm in a GR group kind of here at PIL, show you the GR part of the code. There's two options for treating neutrinos. There's an efficient and simple neutrino leakage scheme, and then there's a more complicated neutrino transport scheme. So for the black holes, I'll be using this leakage scheme. For the neutrinos, I'll be using this more accurate transport scheme. For the 3D simulations at the end, it's effectively this neutrino leakage scheme. So you can download this code except for this energy transport, which is not yet open source, but will be hopefully soon at stellarcollapse.org.
So you're seeing
These two things?
Yep.
So the luminosities and the energies that you predict with the leakage scheme are fairly close to the transport scheme, but if you want to predict what luminosity of neutrinos you'll see, you probably can't do that with a leakage scheme. You kind of have to use transport.
Is the spherical symmetry thought to be a good approximation, or is that just because that's computational?
Yeah, so it depends what you're looking at. So I'll try and justify using it for black holes. For things like neutrinos, it's the average will be the same. So if you were to do a 3D simulation and take a spherical average of the neutrino luminosity, you'll probably get the same number. But then there'll be some variations on top of that in 3D, like 1C and 1D. But those variations are probably of order 10%. So for something like a neutrino luminosity, it's also probably kind of good. But you won't get an explosion in 1D. So that's a problem. Yeah. So this is the GR, GR1D. This is the metric. Radial gauge polar slicing, so there's no shift. And these two metric coefficients, the lapse and the radial component, are just calculated from ODEs. So simple ODEs, you don't actually have to evolve the metric. You can just recalculate the metric every time step from the hydro variables. This is what a typical evolution towards a black hole looks like in GR1D. You start with an iron core. So the iron core is roughly a solar mass and a half. This is this 1.5 here. And it's around 1,000 kilometers. And that'll collapse in to nuclear densities, at which point your shock will form. So this blue line is the shock. This is the radial position of various mass coordinates are these lines here, and this is the shock, and these are subneutrino properties versus post-bounce time. So here the shock forms, it propagates out, it stalls, and then it slowly accretes in as matter falls down through the shock. And this one ultimately makes a black hole down here at around half a second after bounce occurs. So why I will justify using spherical symmetry to look at black holes is because this region out here is supersonic. So sonically, it's disconnected from everything that's happening down here. So even in a 3D simulation, as long as you don't have any rotation, what this material sees out here is basically just how much mass is in the center. It doesn't care what it's doing. It doesn't care about turbulence or convection or anything like that, because it's sonically disconnected. And so the accretion rate of this material through the shock really just depends on the progenitor structure of the star. It doesn't depend on all these multidimensional things that could be happening down here. And so if you're looking for black hole formation, which essentially just depends on how heavy this protoneutron star is, then you really only care about the accretion rate onto that protoneutron star, which is kind of a spherical thing. And so that's how we justify spherical symmetry.
On this kind of plot, I see these simulations of saucy boats flopping around. How big are those? I mean, they always look very big, but maybe I'm comparing them to the size of the neutron star. So would those be up around 100?
Like the convective motions?
Yeah.
So that depends on how many dimensions you simulate your star in. so if you want to just wait, you'll see. But typically, and so in 2D, they're of order 50% of the shock radius. So you might, this might go up and down by 50% in 2D. In 3D, it's more like maybe 5 or 10%.
Do you mean to say that that the accretion rate basically only depends on gravity at that stage? I mean, it's not that all the blowing out has already occurred? And it's
well, so for, sorry, yeah. If you make the assumption that your supernova will fail, and so the shock never gets pushed out, then the accretion rate will just depend on the total mass. Yeah.
What's going on at 0.4 seconds? Why? What's yeah. the middle of this continuity, and why does stuff stop falling in?
Right. So this is zoomed in. Sorry.
Okay.
So this is like 0.3, 0.4, 0.4075.
Okay. I see.
So this is just zooming in, so you can see the proto-neutron star start to collapse in on itself. So you'll see that on this movie as well.
Can I just, before you go on?
Yep.
I just wanted to ask, so can I just check I've got this straight? You're basically taking a fixed, but you're taking a particular background geometry. You've got a lot of, you know, all the matter physics going on the background geometry. You evolve that forward, and then you sort of tweak that M of R function.
Yeah, so every time step, we recalculate M of R, recalculate the lapse.
Okay. And so you can check how good that approximation is, because, I mean, obviously, what you've written down is not the most general spherically symmetric time-dependent geometry, right?
No, so he's using, I think maybe it's a matter of terminology, so he's actually using a fully constrained way of evolving the equations, mm-hmm. and because it's spherical symmetry, you don't have any degree of freedom. You can just degree of freedom. You can just obtain by solving the momentum and Hamiltonian constraint, the magic variable. So that's what he's doing.
But if I look at that and I fix my gauge, sort of, so my radius, you know, is fixed to the area. In general, wouldn't I expect some more freedom in that, not just M of R?
And the gauge. So the gauge is tight. So the gauge is tight. So he's put. See, he has a second equation. So one comes from the momentum constraint, the other comes from the Hamiltonian constraint. So he has one for M of R and the other one for the gauge.
It's a perfect fluid, so you don't have
to. Right. So there is a sort of cross term.
I think this is the most technical thing you can
find. Mm-hmm. It's very good.
It's fine.
Whereas it's exactly the same thing that chopped at the. Okay. And it's got the critical.
So it's worth pointing out that with this, you can never actually have a black hole, because this will be singular. But you can get arbitrarily close. So that's what this is here. It's getting arbitrarily close, but it'll never actually get there. The time step's getting smaller and smaller. It'll never actually get to the point. But for what I'm concerned with, because I'm looking at more on time scales of hundreds of milliseconds or tens of milliseconds, it's effectively good enough. So this is a movie of basically, it's not the same star, but it's the same idea. The shock stalls, it slowly accretes in, and then around here, at around a second, you'll see this neutron star start to collapse in on itself. And the density goes up.
So this is a quick question. I guess I might have missed this. So you have radiative transfer in this, or?
For this is leakage. So for the black hole stuff, it's neutrino leakage.
So it's that diffusion, or?
So it's an interpolation between a diffusive limit, which happens in the core, and a free streaming limit, which is more relevant further out. Yeah. I'll explain it more in the third part. So we do this for lots of stars, hundreds of stars, and here I plot the time it takes to form a black hole. So half a second, or like that one on the last page was half a second. That was actually this point right here, or two slides ago. And plot it versus the zero-age main sequence mass of the star. So we get a particular model from a stellar evolutionist. We put it in GR1D. We evolve it till we get a black hole, and this is the time. The takeaway point from this slide is that there's not really a clear mapping between how long it takes to form a black hole, which is has to do with the progenitor structure at the time of collapse, to the initial mass of the star. And you can maybe see why. There's 10 million years of stellar evolution in there that will mess things up. So our idea is, instead of, and if you go to a textbook, this is what you'll see, all stars of up 20 solar masses form black holes. But that's not what, that's obviously not what happens. So these guys, so obviously these all form black holes because they're not exploding. But these guys form black holes very quickly. So these are intuitively more likely to form a black hole than these ones, where you have to wait around for 3 seconds until you make a black hole.
So it's the argument there that 3 seconds is enough time for the shock to get
regenerated? Yeah, that's the idea. So it's not clear. I can't tell you what stars explode and what stars don't. But I can tell you that stars that form black holes very quickly have huge accretion rates, because you have to get that mass there to form the black hole in a very short amount of time. So they have huge ram pressures. And intuitively, that's harder to explode, because you have to have this much higher pressure behind shock to get it to explode. And we actually do find that the higher the faster a black hole forms, the harder it is to explode that star. So we can fake explosions in 1D by pumping in energy. And we find that we have to pump in more energy for stars that make black holes quicker, because you have to blow it up quick. Otherwise, you'll form a black hole.
How does that scale with the accretion rate? Because naively, I would imagine one possible power source would be accretion power, right? So I mean, people are talking a little bit about trying to.
And it is. So the neutrino heating obviously depends on the neutrino luminosity, which basically is set by the accretion rate.
So does the difficulty, the amount of power you have to pump in, just scale as m dot?
No. So it scales with m dot, but then for very high m dots, it becomes even harder to explode, taking into account that you have more neutrinos. Taking into account that your heating is higher, you actually have to inject a higher percentage of energy in than you do for lower masses. So I'll show you a plot in 2 slides.
But before you go on, what was the blue and what was the red? What's the difference between
them? Blue is solar metallicity stars, and red is low zero metallicity stars. So not only does it depend on the initial mass of the star, it depends on basically the mass loss history of the star, which depends on the metallicity. So these stars lose more than 90% of their mass in their life from winds, because the metallicity is high. These ones have very little iron, so they have very little winds. And at the end of their life, it's basically a 75 solar mass star at the end of its life, whereas this guy is a 5 solar mass star. And so this one very quickly makes a black hole. This one really looks more like these guys over here, because it's lost so much mass.
Well, I guess one last question on that plot is, there's these beautifully systematic valleys, but then we see a couple fluctuations.
Yeah.
Do you believe the fluctuations? Are there good physical reasons for those? Or?
So,
does that give an idea of the scatter?
Yeah, so this is really a question that we've struggled with, and it's really stellar evolution that's tough to answer it. And there's different things going on here. So at 20 solar masses, you see that. So wherever there isn't a point, you can assume that it takes longer than 3.5 seconds. So all these guys actually take longer than 3.5 seconds. But somewhere around 20, you start to form black holes really quickly, and then it shuts off again at 25 solar masses. So you'll see this in a couple slides as well. The idea is, or what I've been told, is that 20 solar masses, carbon stops burning convectively in the core and starts burning radiatively. And so you have this huge jump in the central entropy of the star. And if your entropy goes up, then the iron core you can support is larger. And so generally, you'll have a higher accretion rate and a quicker black hole formation. So that's basically shown here. Some stars have more mass at larger at smaller radii. They're more compact in the sense that this, in some measurement of m over r, they're more compact. So we choose m equals 2.5 solar masses and r equals that radius. So this star here, this 40 solar mass star, is more compact than maybe this 120 solar mass star or this 30 solar mass star here. And this one, this 2.5 solar masses, which is around 5,000 kilometers, has to fall into the origin before you can make a black hole. 2.5 solar masses is roughly the mass that will make a black hole. And if you say, how long will that take? How long does it take to free fall 5,000 kilometers? It's about half a second. If you ask how long does it take to free fall from 15,000 kilometers, then it's more like 5 seconds or 3 seconds. Maybe that's not clear. So at the end of the day, what matters when you're looking to make a black hole is how quickly can you get enough mass to make that protoneutron star unstable to collapse to a black hole. Take that mass that you need to be around 2.5 solar masses. And some stars, that 2.5 solar masses is very close to the origin at the time when the core is collapsing. And so it doesn't take very long to fall down to the origin. Some stars is very far out, and it takes a much longer time to fall in. Remember I said it was supersonically collapsing? And so if it's supersonically collapsing, there's basically no pressure support, and it's free falling. So free fall time is a good approximation. So if I take this compactness, m over r, and plot black hole formation time versus this compactness, you can see the relationship I'm talking about. For stars with high compactness, which means they have basically a lot of mass at small radii, large iron cores, they form black holes very quickly because it doesn't take very long for that stuff to accrete down to the origin. For stars with small iron cores, where that mass is located at very large radii, it takes a long time to fall in, and it'll take a long time to form a black hole. This dashed line is just this free fall time I was talking about. So roughly, that's how it goes. The different colors are different equations of state. Some equations of state need more mass before they're unstable to collapse to a black hole. So you need to wait longer time. So some equations of state, it takes longer. That's why these points are up here. So any questions?
So I keep wondering, when you say forming a black hole, what that exactly means? Because, I mean, it kind of depends on the coordinate. And I guess in the coordinates that you're using, you never actually form a black hole.
Yeah, but for all intents and purposes, if I could evolve a black hole, it would form immediately after my simulation comes to a halt.
So you have a practical definition of what you call a black hole, which is something just before becoming a black hole.
Yeah. When that protoneutron star is collapsing, that's basically a black hole. Because nothing's going to stop it from collapsing. So even though I can't technically find an apparent horizon,
So this T black hole is the time between, but the end of it is when the neutrino star starts collapsing.
Yeah.
And the beginning of it is when.
When the matter reaches nuclear density. Yeah. And you're right. I mean, this is off by some fraction of a millisecond, but I don't really care on these timescales. What the action, the precise time is. So. Quickly, I'll show you this plot. So this is, coming back to your question, this is the fraction of energy I need to inject back into the material to get an explosion. And so for high compactness, I need to inject more and more energy to get an explosion. And so I'm running short of time, so I'm not going to talk about this slide, but if you're interested in it, we can talk after. But basically, this plot is what leads us to the conclusion that Stars with a high compactness will form black holes. Stars with a low compactness will explode as a supernova.
You set that threshold by the upturn and
yeah.
Point?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And so if you take this definition, that stars with a compactness greater than 0.45 will form a black hole, then the black regions in here are the regions in parameter space where black holes form. For various, this is the zero metallicity model set that you saw, the red dots on the slides past, and this is the blue dots, the solar metallicity. So for zero metallicity, when you're not losing mass to winds, it's all these stars become black holes. Whereas solar metallicity, these guys lose so much material that they're probably easy to explode at the end of their life. So you can fold that with an IMF and get a remnant distribution if you want. These are neutron stars, these are black holes. There's things missing in here, and you notice that we don't predict, or we don't find what the black hole mass distribution is observed, which was closer to 8 solar masses. We get higher masses. But we do see some population of black holes, obviously, if we have black holes up there. So for 4%, roughly, 4% of core collapse events will fail, is our prediction for solar metallicity stars.
So I guess, is it either or? So you either form black holes or you have explosion, you cannot have both?
You can have both. So that's this fallback here. You can explode, and then some material isn't unbound and falls back and pushes the neutron star over its, yeah. So this is the percentage of failed core collapse supernova. Yeah. Not necessarily the percentage of black holes. Yeah. Okay, so now I'll go on and talk about neutrinos. This is neutrinos observed in 1987 from supernova 1987A. We saw about 20 neutrinos in 1987. Now we expect with a detector like Snow Plus, you get hundreds of events. With something like Super Kamiokande, you get maybe 10,000 events from the next galactic core collapse supernova. And so what can these neutrinos tell us about the progenitor star? Can it tell us perhaps what the compactness of that star is, just based on the neutrino signal itself. And then if you could combine this with, say, an observation of a progenitor star, then you could learn something about stellar evolution or put constraints on stellar evolution. This is the neutrino luminosity from 32 different simulations. So stars ranging from 12 solar masses up to 40 solar masses. And the luminosity in neutrinos you get out ranges from down here for like a 12 solar mass star at 30 times 10 to the 51 up to something that's maybe 4 times bigger for the 40 solar mass star. So a range of neutrino luminosities of a factor of 4 just purely based on the progenitor structure of the star.
What about the peak in the electron neutrinos? How high does it go up? Is all the luminosity in there, or is it?
Yeah, so this peak here goes up to 300, but it's very narrow, so there's not a lot of energy in there. In the integrated amount, there's not a lot in here. If you had a sensitive detector, which was sensitive to both electron neutrinos and antineutrinos, you could see this, but it would have to be sensitive and have to see electron neutrinos, which is hard to do. But there's, even though the peak's very high, it's very thin. It's like 10 milliseconds or 20 milliseconds thin. So there's not a lot of integrated neutrinos in there.
What's the time resolution of a typical neutrino detector?
In principle, for typical galactic distances, they can determine every event individually. And they don't really have to worry about pileup.
Yeah, but can they? I mean, the time resolution is good enough to distinguish the peak.
Yeah, it's like would be so. It would be like a microsecond or less, the timing of an event. Yeah, if you had like Betelgeuse explode and Super K looking at it, you would not be able to distinguish the events because they're coming in so fast. Something like Ice Cube it's bigger. It's more like maybe a millisecond is their time, because they read out their detectors every once in a while.
What's the implied time and precision given the number of events per second they're likely to see, right? So supernova 1978 saw seven events all in a fairly narrow range of times, but you couldn't produce a light curve for this.
I'll show that plot. Yeah. Maybe, and if there's a question, then you can ask me then. I'm gonna skip all these slides for time. This is the integrated luminosity instead of just as a time series. For electron antineutrinos, I pick antineutrino because this is what something like Super K will see. They'll see the anti-electron neutrinos. And so this basically shows the same thing, that this is milliseconds. For 300 milliseconds after bounce, there's a range which is roughly a factor of 2 or 3 in the total energy observed from different progenitors.
So this is 300 seconds or milliseconds?
This is milliseconds, yeah, sorry. Yep. Sorry. And this is, again, essentially the same thing, but here I plot number of neutrinos observed in something like Super K for a supernova 10 kiloparsecs. So this is using snow globes. It basically takes a neutrino luminosity and converts it into detected events. So in something like Super K, for a supernova 10 kiloparsecs, at 300 milliseconds, these low compactness progenitors will give you 1,500 events. This is in thousands. Whereas a high compactness might give you more like 5,000 events. And so if you think of this, the just statistics on 1,000 events or 5,000 events, you're going to be able to pin down where in this, you're going to be able to, for the next galactic supernova, draw a curve in here with very small error bars and really learn something about the progenitor structure, whether it's a low compactness star or a high compactness star. And of course, you'll learn lots of other things too, but this is just an obvious thing you can learn with very little statistics. Even a detector like Snow Plus that only sees maybe a factor of 100 less events or a factor of 20 less events, we'll still be seeing lots of neutrinos in this time window with very good statistics. So this early post-bounce pre-explosion neutrino signal can really tell us detailed information about the massive star. So that would be great if we could see, great if a supernova went off. We can kind of already do this. We can take the data from 87 and plot this with it. So this is the same number I showed on the last slide, except now I choose the distance to 87A, which is 5 times further, so 25 times less neutrinos. And then this thick black line is the events from 87A from Super K. So in the first 350 milliseconds, there was 4 events. These neutrinos might oscillate from electron type to muon type along the way. So, and we can't know exactly what that number will be, we don't yet know, but it's somewhere in between these two. The curve will see. And so even for the most pessimistic case, it looks like 87A looks more like these less compact stars than these more compact stars. That's probably, you could probably have said this without this plot, because these guys make black holes in half a second. And we know 87A didn't make a black hole in half a second. We know it wasn't a failed supernova, because we saw it. And the neutrinos lasted for at least 12 seconds. So we know that this neutrino signal must have lasted for at least 12 seconds. But given the low number of statistics, you can't really say anything else. But for the next galactic Kirchhoff supernova, there'll be much better statistics.
does this match up well with the kind of, I mean, we have observations of 1987A4, the supernova, right?
So, yeah, so. They're not what people would have predicted. So 87A was a blue supergiant and 18 solar masses, which is not what typically you would think. An 18 solar mass star, you would expect to be a red supergiant. So that was when it first exploded, that was a big puzzle. And now they can explain why it's a blue supergiant, because it's rotating and all these different things are happening. So they can explain it now, but they probably wouldn't have guessed that ahead of time.
So how would rotation explain blue?
Well, so the transition to red supergiant depends on details of the different shells burning. And so in some models, you can get transitions between blue supergiants and red supergiants during the evolution. And so the idea is, during one of these, it happened to explode when it was in the blue supergiant phase.
So then it's blue, it says it's, I mean, how can the supergiant be blue? Is it because it's a small, or?
It's smaller and it's much hotter, yeah. So its radius is smaller and its effective temperature is in the blue, as opposed to in the red. Okay, so now I'll talk about this last bit on some 3D simulations of explosions. This is probably the most sophisticated set of simulations so far, and they're done by the Garching Group in Germany. They're 2D, they're ray by ray plus, this is their transport scheme. So they do neutrino transport. It's conformally flat. And they get explosions, as I said before, but under energetic explosions from progenitors ranging from 8.1 solar masses up to 27. These are the only ones they've done. So in between, maybe they don't explode, but they don't know because they didn't do the simulations yet. And maybe the most interesting one, or the one I'll talk about a little more, is this 27 here. So they found, so this is this shock variation you were asking about. So it's about here, it's around 40%. In their 8.1 star, they found that the neutrino mechanism was aided by neutrino-driven convection. This is the hydrodynamic process that isn't there in 1D, but is there in 2D and help the neutrino mechanism explode the star. In the 27 star, they found something else. It wasn't neutrino-driven convection. It was the standing accretion shock instability. So this instability is where you have vortexes accreted down from the shock. They come down, they hit the protoneutron star. Protoneutron star rings a little, sends acoustic waves up. And those acoustic waves hit the shock, perturb the shock, and then this is an instability. So those perturbations come down, continues to go around. And you can show that the fastest growing mode of this instability is an L equals 1 sloshing mode. So the shock starts to slosh up and down, and that's what they see in this figure here. And it goes unstable, and eventually the star explodes.
So what does it mean to slosh up and down? I mean, isn't it spherically symmetric, or I'm not?
This is axis. These are 2D, so they're axisymmetric. And so it's going up and down the axis.
So this is like a cut through the.
This is, sorry. This is an entropy color map of the North Pole and the South Pole. And this distinguishing region is the shock. So the shock is going up and down, and then antiphase with the South Pole. Sorry. But the obvious question is, it's sloshing up and down the axis of your 2D simulation. So if you were to do this in 3D, are you going to see that as well, where you don't have this preferred axis? So it's an obvious question. So we do some simulations of this same star, the 27 solar mass star, in 3D using GR simulations. We use Elmani, which is based on the Einstein toolkit, and Cactus and Carpet. And these are simulations led by Christian at Caltech. The source code for the neutrino leakage, which I talked about before, which was what we used in 1D, we port it to 3D, and you can go download this if you want. Cactus-based neutrino leakage treatment. And these are all the authors. Eric's part of this as well. This is one slide about the neutrino leakage we use, and I kind of already talked about it in the sense that it's an interpolation between a diffusive component and a free emission component. And then we also have a neutrino heating. So, okay, put yourself along a ray in 3D. You can calculate for every point along that ray how much energy is emitted via our leakage scheme. And you can sum up that as you go out in radius to get some luminosity, some angle average luminosity. And then that neutrinos will heat the matter. There's some cross-section, neutrino cross-section of the neutrinos in the matter, and that will heat the matter. This is the neutrino mechanism, which I've neglected to explain so far, but is the gist of it. You have neutrinos coming from the core, cooling the matter, but as they get to lower radii, they end up heating the matter. So they inject energy behind the shock and ultimately will cause it to explode if it's successful. This is, since it's leakage, it's quite parameterized. We have this parameter that we can set to anything we want to change the amount of heating we actually have in our simulation. And we choose four different numbers here. I guess it's worth noting that in 1D, you need to set F heat to 1.18 in order to get an explosion. This is a movie of the simulation with F heat equals 1.15. So the highest value of FE. That's the shock front you see. That's some grid perturbations. So this is the shock front. Matter is accreting, and you can't really see it because it's so cold. And this is an entropy color map. But you'll, as the neutrinos start to heat the matter, you'll start to see another layer, another entropy slice of the volume render. So this is one particular value of the entropy. As the neutrinos heat it up, and then it will accrete in to lower radii. And there's also a shell of it right behind the shock as well. You'll start to see another layer we pick out with a slightly higher entropy that'll come in yellow. And then a third one, which is red, which will come in as well. And you can see it's not spherical, it's not axisymmetric. It's exploding in some random direction. Visually, you don't see something like a standing accretion shock. So this is for the four different values of F heat. This is the picture you just saw at the end at 150 milliseconds. When you don't have as high heating, your shock radius at 150 milliseconds is smaller because you don't have that energy being injected in much. And then for F equals 1, it's very small. This is kind of what some tracers of what's going on. This is the shock radius. So for this the high heating, the 1.15, the shock radius is going up very quickly, whereas the 1, it's failing, so it's not exploding. There's some other measures of what's going on as well. I'll just leave those for the sake of time. And this plot is just showing that these three, so the 1.05, 1.1, 1.15, will likely ultimately explode, even though we only simulated 100 or 200 milliseconds. But this one, the one, is most likely not going to explode. So getting to the question that we asked at the beginning, do we see the standing accretion shock instability in three dimensions? So this is the amplitude of, you take the shock, you decompose it into spherical harmonics, and you look at the L equals 1 modes. These are the fastest growing SASE modes. And you can see that you do see some periodic oscillation of these L equals 1 modes in the simulation. So this is SASE right here, these oscillations. But their amplitudes are very small. They're 2 or 3%. They're not 40%. So this is what the Garching group saw in 2D. They have the amplitudes of the L equals 1 mode, which is the black line, around 40 or 50%. So very strong SASE in 2D, whereas we don't really see any in 3D. There's some very new results which has just come out in the past week of the same regression group doing simulations in 3D now. And they also see SASE in 3D, but here the amplitudes are much smaller. So the thick colored lines here is 3D, and their amplitudes are in different units, but are 5 kilometers oscillation in the shock front, which is about 5% if your shock radius is around 100 kilometers. So in 3D, their SASE amplitudes seem to be much smaller than they are in 2D. Although it's kind of weird, they have 2D results on here, which are also very small. So we don't see the SASE, but we do see lots of convection. And so in our simulations that do explode, the explosions are aided by neutrino-driven convection. So remember, in 1D, all of these values of F heat wouldn't explode. But when you add in that convection, then it's able to assist the neutrino mechanism and aid in an explosion. So red regions here are unstable to convection. So you have material coming up and down here. That's getting constantly reheated by the neutrinos. So as material comes to higher densities, it's more efficient at capturing neutrinos, and then it goes back up and helps heat that region. These are gravitational waves we see from our simulation. So for F heat equals 1.05 and 1.15, amplitudes of gravitational waves of order 5 centimeters at 10 kiloparsecs. So around 10 to the minus 21 strain. You see, when you compare this to 2D, you kind of see the same thing as you saw with the SASE modes. That in 2D, the gravitational wave amplitudes are very high. They're of order 20 or 30 centimeters. But in 3D, they're down by almost an order of magnitude. So in 3D, you don't have, in 2D, you have large coherent motions because it's an axisymmetric system. In 3D, you lose that coherentness, and this drives down the gravitational wave amplitudes.
In these simulations, you see the beginning of the collapse of the neutron star to the black hole, but do you see a significant amount of accretion? I guess there is accretion through the shock. I would have imagined some significant fraction of the gravitational wave signal coming from accretion of the fallback disk and any heterogeneities in that process.
You mean like after an explosion or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, people have tried to estimate those. If you can assume your disk fragments or something, then you'll get really large gravitational waves. Because then you have large, compact, massive objects going around in an accretion disk.
Do they see things like that, or do they have to put them in by hand? That
has never really been done in 3D. Something where you typically people, they might start with an accretion disk and see what happens, but they don't actually form the accretion disk. And even some of these things where you get these fragments, you have to assume some things about your equation of state in order for that to happen. So. Yeah.
Even these waveforms, are they coming preferentially within some window of frequencies, or?
Yeah. So for supernova, it's hundreds typically,
okay.
600 to 1,000. It kind of depends on. It depends on your equation of state, kind of. It also depends on how you simulate it. So if you use neutrino transport, then you'll typically get a higher frequency than if you don't use neutrino transport for various reasons. But 600, 700, 800, yeah. Generally, that increases with time. So there's you maybe can learn stuff from the frequency domain as well. These early things is from prompt convection in the protoneutron star. And they're large and very low frequency. At later times, turbulence and SASE are much higher frequency. And as your protoneutron star shrinks to smaller radii, then your frequencies will get higher as well, because you can get down to smaller radii. Okay, so in summary, black holes can, we know form in core collapse supernova. The question is which ones do. So it strongly depends on the stellar evolution of the star. So whether or not at the end of its life you have a high compactness or a small compactness, a large iron core or a small iron core. Thankfully, we can learn about this if we observe neutrinos from a galactic core collapse supernova, because we can learn about the structure of that pre-supernova star, and allow us to maybe connect the properties of the interior to what we observe if we can observe the progenitor. So it would be a great constraint for stellar evolution. Full 3D simulations of core collapse supernova seem to behave very different than 2D simulations. And something I didn't talk about, but we find that small perturbations, which you may expect from stellar evolution naturally, may suppress the development of the SASE. And so I didn't touch on that. You can ask me if you want, and I can explain. Thanks.
So this last point, when you lower it.
Yeah, so the idea is you saw the perturbations from the Cartesian grid in the movie. So those are of order 10%. So they perturb the background density from its spherical average by about 10%. This basically gives imperfections in the incoming accretion flow that can seed convection. So normally you need some small perturbation to start convection. If it's small enough and you can evect it through the host shock region down onto the proneutron star before it has time to grow, then you wouldn't ever get convection. So this is a way, if your perturbations are really small, you can suppress convection by just evecting it away. And instead you would get something like the standing accretion shock. If you have large perturbations, though, then you can seed and start convection before it can evect away. There's a critical number that these guys came up with. It's roughly 3. If your seed growth time is 3 or larger, 3 times larger than the evection time, then you'll be able to start convection going vigorously. If it's smaller than that number, then it's just will be evected away and you won't see its effects. And so because we have these perturbations from our Cartesian grid, that's why we say we get lots of convection and this suppresses the SASE. But we estimate that these perturbations might be what you expect from a normal star, just from normal advanced burning stages giving perturbations in the background density, which will be roughly around 5 or 10% is what we estimate.
Could this obviously happen with the resolution, like MRI, or not have enough resolution to capture the
if you compare it with the Euler resolution?
Yeah, the resolutions are similar. I mean, our conclusion is that they have so little perturbations because they use a spherical grid, and they have spherical accretion. They don't have any perturbations from their background grid, and they have very little to start with because they don't perturb there, or they perturb it very little, that they just don't have these perturbations to seed convection, whereas we get them just from our refinement boundary. And even if you didn't have the refinement boundary, you would still have it from the spherical flow going through a Cartesian grid. You're going to have flows not perpendicular or parallel to grid boundaries. So you will get perturbations.
So I'm just wondering, shouldn't you, maybe you mentioned this earlier in the talk, which I missed, shouldn't you expect some sort of like the initial condition be in sort of like disk-like because I mean, if something collapsing and if you have some initial angular momentum,
typically the angular momentums aren't large enough to dramatically affect the structure. So if there are things called like fizzlers, where you have so much angular momentum that you never actually collapse to nuclear densities, because you're centrifugally supported by that angular momentum. But stellar evolution models don't ever really give that angular momentum at the end of the star's life. It's
like
usually small enough that you wouldn't.
Like
you
think you
see,
mentioned about 1987A, that that's because of rotation, right?
Yeah, but the rotations you need to really affect the structure in the core are very large. Yeah. You need to start the stars with abnormally high rotation rates. And when you do this, at the end of the day, you look at the pulsars you predict, and they're all spinning super, super fast, and that's not what we observe. Pulsars are generally spinning pretty slow.
But they also spin down almost instantly. Right? I mean, that's so it's not inconsistent to think that every pulsar is born a millisecond pulsar, that they live like a year like that, if that. No,
I think that it is inconsistent, because even though they spin down, I don't know if they can spin down to like a second or 10 seconds, which is what we observe some pulsars. Maybe not pulsars.
Well, when they quote pulsar ages, you quote how old it has to be to have spun down from infinite specific. So they do go back.
Okay, maybe, but my impression was that it's inconsistent to have all stars spinning that fast.
Oh, that's certainly all stars, all progenitors don't just go spinning fast enough. Measure.
Yeah.
Period.
Perhaps in view of the timing, we should carry on the discussion over lunch. Let's get the end.